right. Thank you very much, Kaylee and Cambria. You may have noticed the instantaneous change from a podium to a music stand. So we did pre-record that as well because the girls were a little nervous. This is the first time they've ever performed special music, obviously. So very much appreciate Cambria and Kaylee Huffnitz performing that for us today, this special music. They've been playing violin for a few years now. I don't know if, I don't think they've played together before like this. So their first time, and they were so nervous, but they did a great job, and hopefully you were all able to enjoy that, and we thank you so much for you girls doing that today. All right, so we'll get into the message today. In the lead-up to Pentecost this year, we've been going through with Mr. Bradford quite a few sections in the Bible on prophecy. As he said before, we've been going through Revelation, Daniel, and one of those chapters that we've covered quite extensively is Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24, and the prophecy starts in verse 3, and really it's an amazing setting here that it paints, this picture that it paints in Matthew 24, 3. It says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately, and they asked him a few questions." So they're sitting on this mountain overlooking the city of Jerusalem, probably around sunset sometime. We don't know what time of day exactly, but they have this beautiful view, and they're privately asking Christ these questions. "Tell us, when will these things be?" So when? "And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So again, how amazing this setting would be. And as Mr. Bradford said, it's a good thing for us today that they ask these questions. So we get to hear the answers because they ask these questions. So here in Matthew 24, then, Christ continues to describe some of the events that will be the signs that will occur before his coming. In the verses that we've read through now in the last few months, the first four seals and the fifth seal and all of those things. And then in verse 36 is where Christ starts to answer, when will these things happen? That when question that the disciples asked him. Matthew 24 and verse 36 says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." So nobody knows when. And he follows that up with this statement, "Therefore, you also," now you, he's talking to the disciples here privately, obviously, but really he's talking to all of his first fruits. He says, "You be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Christ's message to his disciples and his first fruits today is to be ready. And as Mr. Bradford said this morning, to be ready implies that being a first fruit goes beyond just receiving the gift of salvation. Now, yesterday we read Matthew chapter 7, where Jesus Christ tells us that at the end of the age, many will say, "Lord, Lord." We're ready, they're going to say to him. We are ready. We've prophesied. We've cast out demons. We've done some amazing things, some wondrous works. We're ready to enter your kingdom. Yet Christ says, "I never knew you. Depart from me because you're not ready." This tells us that many have the wrong idea of what it means to be ready. So in the message this afternoon, let's paint a picture for all of us here, all of us listening, each individual first fruit out there listening, a picture hopefully that shows how the Bible tells us a first fruit can be ready. To paint this picture for the core of the message today, we'll put together and unpack three groups of verses found in the New Testament. We'll sprinkle in a couple other verses as we go through, but for some flavor, but the core of the message today is going to be three groups of verses that'll form the bulk of this picture that we want to paint today. On the screen here, you'll see each group is represented by a rectangle. So if you're taking notes, you can draw these rectangles in your notes, or you can use a page in each of your notes for these different groups of verses that we're going to go through. Either way, at the end, hopefully, we'll have painted a clear picture of exactly how each individual first fruit can truly be ready at the end of this age. So hopefully that makes sense. Let's get started now by looking at our first group of verses where Jesus Christ himself begins to tell us how to be ready. And that happens to be right where we just started in the introduction. We'll go through the verses starting in Matthew 24, verse 45, right through to the end of Matthew 25. Right through to the end of Matthew 25. We just read in Matthew 24, 44, where Jesus Christ tells his disciples to be ready. And he doesn't leave us hanging. The rest of the Olivet prophecy is Jesus Christ showing us just how to be ready. And he does this by sharing four parables. Now, we often pull out and read these parables individually. Each of these four can really stand on their own. But Christ was a master storyteller. He was the master parable teller. And if we follow this story flow through, these four parables, we end up somewhere maybe a little bit unexpected as far as how we can be ready. So let's go through these four parables as a group, starting with the first, which is the parable of the faithful and the evil servant. In Matthew 24, verse 45. There's two types of servants present in the church at the end of this age. The first is a faithful and wise servant, and we read about him in Matthew 24, verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? So let's take a moment to just unpack this one verse, because there's a lot in this verse that's really important. What is the house of the master, or the ruler of the household of the master today? Well, 1 Timothy 3, verse 15 tells Timothy, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the ground of truth. So the house of God today is the church. And here in this parable, the faithful and the wise servant is one who feeds and nurtures the household of God, that gives the household food in its due season, throughout the holy day season, that guides the household of God through the events of Matthew 24 that Christ has already gone through. That's a very key concept packed into this verse here, and the entire next chapter, Matthew 25, kind of expands upon this concept. But let's go on in verse 46 here. It says, blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. Okay, so that's the one servant of God here, the wise servant who is blessed by God. But there's another type of servant in verse 48. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master delays his coming, or is delaying his coming. And notice that the evil servant, he's not verbalizing this. He says this in his heart. Subconsciously, he says, hey, wait a minute. I don't see the abomination of desolation happening yet. I don't see false prophets performing great signs yet. I've got time. And notice what actions this evil servant starts to show when these thoughts enter his heart. Verse 48, but if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards. So instead of looking after and serving his master's household, this servant beats the other members of his household, of the master's household. Now the Greek word for beats here is to pummel repeatedly, is what it means in Greek, to pummel repeatedly, to beat down. And this can be physically, but this can also be verbally as well. To make sure that you stay down in your place, down there below me. Instead of providing food in due season for the household, lifting them up and nurturing them like the wise servant does, this servant provides food and drink only for himself and in abundance for himself, bringing down the rest of the house, causing division. So we have these two servants contrasted here. Verse 50, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him and at an hour that he is not aware of. This servant here, the evil servant, is comfortable with the way that things are while his master is away in his master's absence. He has no sense of urgency. And here is the consequence for that attitude, Christ tells us, and his master will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's this incredible wailing, weeping and gnashing of teeth. The first parable in this group of four gives us some very strong imagery and strong warnings to the disciples of Christ, to the first fruits. And this now sets the stage for the next three parables found in Matthew 25, the next chapter. Matthew 25 even more clearly defines what these evil and wise servants look like. It sort of drills down a little bit more on what these servants look like. Matthew 25, verse 1 through 13 is the parable of the 10 virgins. And we'll just hit the highlights for time because we've all read through this parable so many times. But let me draw out verse 5. It says, but while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. They all got lulled into sleep by the daily routines of life. And we saw that a little bit before this virus came, didn't we? We were kind of going about our life, and then all of a sudden, you know, boom. We were all all the virgins got lulled into sleep by the daily routines of life. But as we know, the difference here between the wise and the foolish virgins is that some of the virgins maintained something while the master was away, while the bridegroom was away. The wise kept oil in their lamps. The foolish didn't. Remember, the evil servant says in his heart, my master delays his coming, and he's okay with that. He's content to eat and drink from the master's table, from the master's household, while the master is away. The evil servant is physically comfortable and self-reliant, not realizing how much he or she actually needs God and Jesus Christ until it's too late. Just like the foolish virgins. And when the midnight cry goes out, their oil is gone. Verse 11, and we read the consequence here. Afterwards, the other virgins, the foolish, came along also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. We're ready now, is what they're saying. Open the door to the kingdom. We're ready. Verse 12, but he answered and said, assuredly I say to you, I do not know you. Very similar to the response that we saw back in Matthew 7 in the Sermon on the Mount. And these here in this parable, let's remember, these were virgins, undefiled from the world. When we read the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, the logical question to ask is, how can I be one of the wise? I think we all read that and we all want to be one of the wise virgins, not one of the foolish. So how do we be one of the wise? How do we keep that oil in our lamps? The answer for that comes in the next parable. Christ gave these parables in order to tell us a story flow here. The next parable is the parable of the talents, which Mr. Bradford touched on this morning in his sermon this morning. Verse 14, for the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. So again, we have this concept that we've already gone through in this other parable. The master goes away or is delayed, and he leaves his servants over his household. He gives them his goods. There are good servants and there are evil servants. Verse 15, and to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and immediately he went on a journey. He went away. He left. A talent was an ancient unit of mass in the time of Christ, and it was often used as a way to measure money. So 1 talent of gold would have been 30 kilos of gold, 30 kilograms of gold. In today's prices, that much gold would have been 2.6 million Australian dollars. Now that was gold. If it was another metal, it still would have been 30 kilograms of another metal would have still been quite a substantial amount of money. Just 1 talent of gold, 1 talent of another metal is enough to make life comfortable. So what did each of these servants do with their master's wealth that he left for them? Then he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. So they exercised what the master had given them in his absence. They bought and they sold. And the original talent, the original gift grew. They used the gifts given by the master to grow his household. Verse 18, but he who had received 1 went and dug it in the ground and hid his Lord's money. Now, wait a minute. What's this servant saying by his actions, by digging that and putting that talent in the ground? This servant is saying, I can get by without using my master's gift. They don't throw the talent away, but they also don't use it. They bury it. The definition of being lukewarm, as we see the Laodicean church. They say, I can get by without this. Verse 19, after a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. So he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more besides. His Lord said, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Again, the doors opened. The servant who received 2 talents did the same thing and was rewarded also. Both of these servants were deemed ready by the master to enter into the joy of the Lord. And why? Why were they deemed ready? Because they had exercised what they were given to build the master's household according to his will. Verse 24, we see with the other servant, his fate. Verse 24, then he who had received 1 talent Now, it's interesting that it's the person who seems to have received the least that it's focusing in on here. I don't know what that means, but it's interesting to think about. He who received one talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. He didn't really lose the talent. He didn't grow the talents. And most importantly, he didn't grow what was important to his master. But his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So ought you have deposited my money with the bankers. And at my coming, I would have received back my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. And there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Just like before, there is a massive negative consequence here for burying what the master left with this servant, with the gift that was given. The point in the question of this parable is asking to the followers of Christ is, are you exercising what you've been given to grow your master's household? Again, as Mr. Bradford said this morning, being a first fruit is more than just receiving salvation. There's something beyond that we are to attain to. Now, again, this parable leaves us with the question, all right, so what is exercising the gifts of God look like? In practical terms, what does a wise servant trading with his master's wealth really look like? What does wise virgin who has oil in their lamps look like? The conclusion of the Olivet prophecy here and the last parable, the crescendo of these stories, shows us in Matthew 25, verse 31. Matthew 25, 31 says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on the throne of his glory and all nations will be gathered before him. Now it says nations here. Strong's defines this word as a race, a tribe, and a people. So nations are collections of tribes. Tribes are collections of families and groups of people. Today, we don't have tribes, but we do have families, and we do have organizations. We do have groups of people. So when it says all nations gathered before him here, let's make this personable for us today. Imagine your family gathered here before God. Imagine your organization gathered here before God. This is a time of judgment here, and we come to verse 32. It says, from among these groups of people, he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left hand. Now remember the context of all that we've talked about, covered so far in the Olivet prophecy here. The master is delayed and his servants are in charge of his household. There are faithful servants and there are evil servants. There are wise servants and there are foolish servants. And now he's separating them out. Verse 34, then the king will say to those on his right hand, those were the sheep there on his right hand, come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. He tells them, this group on his right hand, again, you are ready. Why? Why are they ready? In verse 35, we find out. He says, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. This group has a mindset here. And this mindset of those who are blessed in this parable reminds me a lot of what we read yesterday in Leviticus 23, verse 22. Remember that command? It says, when you're laboring in the field of the first fruit harvest, leave the corners ungleaned. Why is that? To be generous, to take care of the poor and the stranger, so that they too can be nourished. Look after those who are in need, was that command back in Leviticus. And here, Christ is saying, when I was hungry, you gave me food. Verse 37, then the righteous will answer him saying, Lord, Master, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? We thought you were gone and you were delayed. You didn't come, you weren't here. When did we do this? This verse here is so important to the story because it's telling us that this group had no idea what they were doing. I really think this is one of the keys to this parable here. They weren't trying to make to gain points on the board. They weren't doing this for PR. This had become part of who they were, part of their nature, part of who they are. And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, my people, in other words, my household, you did it to me." Christ says, this right here is how my good and my faithful servants, the ones who are ready, will look like at the end of the age. They will be exercising my spirit and my gift. My faithful servants at the end of this age will be exercising what I have given them and the gifts that I've given them at the end of this age. That's how Jesus Christ defines being ready as a first fruit. Now let's contrast the end of this Olivet prophecy here. Let's contrast it with the beginning of the Olivet prophecy. Because in the beginning, we see the prevailing attitudes that are out in the world or out that are common at the end of this age as the world goes through these prophesied events that we know are to come. Matthew 24, verse 10 through 12 says, "And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another." They will hate one another. Do we see this happening in the world today? Absolutely. Look at all the riots that are going on now. Look at how polarized the world is now. Even how we see this sometimes creeping into the church today as well. How polarized we are on each side. There's no middle. The middle is fast disappearing. People are on either side. And people are polarized about everything today. We see this starting to creep in already. That many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and many because lawlessness will abound, the love of many, many people will grow cold. So in the environment that we read about in Matthew 24, it's going to be so hard to express outgoing concern for others. In some ways, like I said, it's becoming like that already. It's already hard to put yourself out there sometimes in the environment that we live in today. It's going to take a lot of resilience and long suffering and strength to not just want to put up our walls and sort of, you know, circle the wagons and grit our teeth and have a every person for themselves mentality. It's going to take help from God to be able to do this as we go through those events of Matthew 24. Yet here in Matthew 25, at the end, these four parables culminate in a picture of what those who are ready to enter the kingdom look like, what they're doing. Those who are ready will be exercising what God has entrusted into their care in the service of others, especially the household of God, the Master's household. So what an amazing picture Christ paints for us here in Matthew chapter 25 of how we as first fruits are to be ready, how we're to prepare. So let's now turn together to 1 Peter chapter 4. Peter here will transition us into our next group of verses that we're going to look at to add to this picture of what each individual first fruit must be doing to be ready. 1 Peter 4 and verse 7. And we'll see a similar outline here that Peter lays out for us, very similar to what we just saw in Matthew 24 and 25. 1 Peter 4 and verse 7 says, "But the end of all things is at hand." Again, this setting is at the end of the age. "Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers." Okay, so prayer and Bible study and that connection with God is important as we face the end time events of Matthew 24. That's the oil in our lamps. That's loving God with all our heart, mind, and soul, which is the first great commandment. We have to have that. But the question is that enough? Is that where we're supposed to stop if we want to be ready? For a long time, I thought that was enough to have that really close relationship with God. That's so important. But what I've grown to realize is that if we truly love God, we won't stop there. We won't leave it at that. Because for the first fruits, it's more than just salvation for us. Verse 8, "And above all things," Peter continues, "have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling." So, wow, that sounds a lot like where Christ took us in Matthew 25. And Peter doesn't even stop there. Let's focus in on verse 10. Verse 10, and as each one has received a gift. Each first fruit, Peter is saying, receives a gift. Yes, the gift of the Holy Spirit, but he's going beyond that here. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another. Minister it here in Greek means be a servant of one another. Use the gift to serve one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Again, this is so similar to where Christ took us in Matthew 25. The master has been delayed and left stewards in control or in charge of his household to give that household food in due season. Okay, now verse 11, now we come to some new territory here that we didn't talk about in Matthew 25. And this will transition us into our second group of verses here. Peter starts to get more specific as to what some of these gifts are. Number one, if anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. The NIV translates this a little bit clearer. It says, if anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. Brad talked about that this morning as the advice that his dad gave him when he started to give sermonettes. We're not just talking here about formal speaking like we're doing now. We're talking about communication, how we talk to each other as well. Being able to articulate and communicate the words of God, not our own words, but God's words, is a gift of the Spirit. It's a gift from the Spirit to be able to understand what God is saying and then be able to clearly articulate that is a gift. That's one category of gift, communication. And he continues, if anyone ministers, and again, the word ministers here means serves. If anyone serves, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies. That in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen. Peter tells us in the context of the end of all things, a very similar message to what Christ said in Matthew 25. Don't bury what God has given you. Use it to feed the household of God. The hungry, the naked, the sick, those in prison, the least of those brethren, the least of our brethren, or the least of God's brethren. So now we're seeing here that each of us is given a specific gift that is to be used in service to others. And there's two broad categories here. We have either speaking, meaning communication in some way, and we have serving. Okay, so with that as a transition, let's move on then to our second group of verses today where the Apostle Paul will help us paint this picture of how each individual first fruits can be ready, can use these gifts. This group is found in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. Peter has established these two broad categories of spiritual gifts, and Paul is going to drill down even more now into these two categories. Romans 12, and for context here, let's start in verse 1. Romans 12 and verse 1. Says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, I beseech you, I beg you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. We have to present ourselves. This is an active process, not a passive one. To be ready as a first fruit, you have to be engaged. The wicked and the lazy servant who buried his gift was not engaged. Paul is begging the church here to be engaged in this process. Now, for the phrase at the end of this verse, the phrase, which is your reasonable service, the Revised Standard Version translates this phrase this way. For that is the only kind of worship which is truly spiritual. And here's what William Barclay writes about this phrase, and specifically the word worship. Because I want to read this because I think it captures the magnitude of what Paul is calling to us to, or God is calling us to, but how Paul is describing this here. So William Barclay says, so Paul says, take your body, take all the tasks that you have to do every day, take the ordinary work of the shop, the factory, the shipyard, the mine, and offer all that as an act of worship to God. The word in Romans 12:1, which we, along with the Revised Standard Version, have translated worship, has an interesting history. The Greek word here, used here, is a noun of a Greek verb. Originally, this verb meant to work for hire or for pay. It was the word used in the laboring man, used of the laboring man, who gave his strength to an employer in return for the pay the employer would give him. It denotes not slavery, but voluntary undertaking of work. It then came to mean, quite generally, to serve. But it also came to mean to that to which a man gives his whole life. For instance, a man could be said to give his life to the service of beauty. In that sense, it came very near meaning to dedicate one's life to. Finally, it came to be a word distinctively used of the service of the gods. In the Bible, it never means human service. It always is used of service to and worship of God. Here we have a most significant thing. True spiritual worship is the offering to God of one's body and all that one does every day with it. Real worship is not the offering to God of a liturgy, however noble, or a ritual, however magnificent. Real worship is the offering of everyday life to Him. Not something transacted in a church, but something which sees the whole world as the temple of the living God. A man may say, I'm going to church to worship God, but he should also be able to say, I'm going to the factory, the shop, the office, the school, the garage, the locomotive shed, the mine, the shipyard, the field, the garden, to worship God. I love how he puts that here. Paul is saying, present your body, present your life in service to God. That is your reasonable service. That's how a first fruit, seeking to be ready, sees his life, even during the mundane parts of the week. And that effort is really, really hard to do. We all miss the mark on that so often. It definitely takes effort and it takes focus. To do this requires a dramatic transformation, which Paul addresses in verse 2. Romans 12 and verse 2. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. The word for transformed here is to be changed both on the inside and the outside. A metamorphosis, like a caterpillar into a butterfly, completely different from beginning to end. Something completely different both on the inside and on the outside. And when he says renewing of your mind, renewed means a complete renovation of. We would put it this way, your mind is completely renovated, or it looks like the mind of God. One of my favorite scriptures is 2 Timothy 1 and verse 6 through 8. 2 Timothy 1, 6 through 8 says, therefore I remind you, Timothy, to stir up the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of my hands. Again, we just saw in Matthew 25, we have to stir up the gifts that God gives us. Use them, exercise them, engage in the process. And how does Paul define the gift here? How does he break it down? For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and of a sound mind. We might put it this way. The gift is this. When you receive the Holy Spirit, God's very essence, the power of God, or the dunamos in Greek, is now within you. That's huge. The love of God, the agape, is now in you. And the mind of God is also now within you. And there's a choice that we face, as Paul says in these verses. We can choose to let that spirit lie dormant, hide it away, bury it, try to do things under our own power, and let our own spirit reign within us. Or we can stir up the Spirit of God, His power and His love and His mind within us. The Holy Spirit in us is something that needs to be stirred and renewed on a regular basis, because our own spirit is always lurking, waiting there to take over. A great visual for this is the daily sacrifices offered at the temple and the tabernacle. The fire was started with this dramatic lightning in Leviticus 9 and 2 Chronicles 7. Then, after that, it was the job of the priests to keep that fire going, to keep it burning through daily and evening sacrifices. It's our job today as first fruits to keep the fire of God, that fire that started in Acts 2, burning brightly within us through daily renewal. So the question is, are we engaged in that process? Are we doing that? Paul says that is your reasonable service and worship. This is where we start. This daily renewal that should transform us and our lives and our motivations from within. A real, a true transformation. So if we go back now to Romans 12, verse 2, Paul has just painted this amazing picture of being completely transformed by exercising and renewing the Spirit of God within us. And he quickly offers a warning here. Verse 3, "For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." As you go through the process of transformation, by the daily exercise of God's incredible gifts to you, you will see growth and you will see transformation in your life. Don't let that go to your head, is what Paul is saying. Stay humble. It's so easy for that attitude of superiority and pride to creep in. It's just knocking at the door. It's wanting to come in, as Brad talked about this morning. How often have we seen that happen within the church of God? So with that warning to stay humble, we are now coming to a section of verses here where Paul goes over some very specific spiritual gifts. This is one of three places that Paul lists specific spiritual gifts. The other two are 1 Corinthians 12 and Ephesians 4. So we have here Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, and Ephesians 4. All three of these places, the analogy of the church as one, and specifically as one body, is always close by this discussion of spiritual gifts. Verse 4, "For as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function. So we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them." Once again, how many places have we read this? A first fruit is made ready by exercising what he or she has been given. Let us use them, Paul emphatically says. I'd like to quote William Barclay here in his commentary on this section, because he highlights 4 points from verse 4. 4 points that I think are quite important in our discussion of how an individual first fruit can be ready. 4 points. He says, beneath this passage lie very important rules of life. Number one, first of all, it urges us to know ourselves. One of the first basic commandments of the Greek wise men was, "Man, know thyself." We do not get very far in this world until we know what we can and what we cannot do. An honest assessment of our own capabilities, without conceit and without false modesty, is one of the first essentials of a useful life. Number two, second, it urges us to accept ourselves and to use the gift God has given us. We are not to envy someone else's gift or regret that some other gift has not been given to us. We are to accept ourselves as we are and use the gift we have. The result may be that we have to accept the fact that service for us means some humble sphere and some almost unseen part. The efficiency of the life of the universe depends on the humblest of creatures. Paul is here saying that a man must accept himself. And even if he finds that his contribution he has to offer will be unseen, without praise and without prominence, he must make it, certain that it's essential, that without it, the world and the church can never be what they were meant to be. Third, Paul is really saying that whatever gift a man has comes from God. We talked about that this morning with Brad. Fourth, whatever gift a man has, he must use it. And the motive of use must be not his personal prestige, but the conviction that it is at one and the same his duty and his privilege to make his own contribution to the common good. So I really like what Barclay has to say here, especially in 1 and 2 there, and 4 as well, and 3, all 4 of them. Knowing that we are to use our gifts that God has given us urges us to know ourselves and to accept ourselves in the gifts that God has given us. To ask God and try to figure out, what spiritual gifts has he given me? Have you ever asked that question? To be honest, I don't think I ever really have until I was sitting down looking at putting this together. Probably because when we start talking about spiritual gifts, my mind goes straight to speaking in tongues and healings. And it gets to be this confusing, mystical like mess of things and an overwhelming subject. Yet we just read multiple places telling us to be ready. It is our responsibility then to be exercising what God is giving us, not burying it. The goal today is to try and demystify the subject of spiritual gifts, and hopefully that's starting to come through. We've already started a little bit with 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter gave us two categories of spiritual gifts: speaking or communicating the words of God, and serving with the power that God gives us. Two broad categories. So we can start there. We have that in our chart there on the screen. Let's go back to Romans 12 now. In the middle of verse 6 here, Paul is going to give us a list of seven more specific spiritual gifts that can be used to nourish the household of the master or build up the body of the church. And I'll read through these verses here, and then we'll briefly unpack these seven different gifts. The middle of verse 6 starts here. It says, "If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Or ministry, let us use it in our ministering. He who teaches in teaching, he who exhorts in exhortation, he who gives with liberality, he who leads with diligence, he who shows mercy with cheerfulness." Okay, so seven gifts here are listed. You'll have to take my word that there's seven. Let's start with the first one, prophecy. We hear prophecy and we automatically think of Old Testament times and predicting the future events. But that isn't quite what the Greek word here means. Vine's Dictionary defines this word for prophecy here as the speaking forth of the mind and counsel of God. It also says, through much of Old Testament prophecy, though much of Old Testament prophecy was purely predictive, prophecy is not necessarily nor even primarily foretelling. It's the declaration of that which cannot be known by natural means. It's the forthtelling of the will of God, whether with reference to the past, the present, or the future. So I really like the approach to prophecy that I found in this book called by Don and Katie Fortune. It's a book called Discover Your God-Given Gifts by Don and Katie Fortune. If you haven't studied into this subject, it's a good starter book. I wouldn't say we agree with everything in this book, but it kind of gives us a balanced approach to especially these seven gifts that we're going through today. And when they talk about prophecy, to avoid all the baggage that we tend to have with that word prophecy in English, they call this gift perceiving. And they say, quote, "The perceiver is one who clearly perceives the will of God. The perceiver is one who readily perceives, prays about, proclaims, and promotes the will of God." Again, as we talked about this morning, that can only be done through the Spirit of God, as a gift from the Spirit of God. So that is the first gift there, which is prophecy or perceiving. Barclay says this is the gift of, the second gift now, as you can see on there, is ministry. Or as William Barclay defines it, practical service. Practical service. Again, Barclay says this is the gift of practical service. It is surely significant that practical service came in Paul's mind so high on the list. It may be that a man who never had the privilege of standing forth in public and proclaiming Christ, but there is no man who cannot every day show the love of Christ in deeds of service to his fellow man. Again, we read about that in the beginning of Romans. Now, in regards to service, I think it's important to mention this. Remember what we read in 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, Peter said, "If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies." The word for ability means strength or the power that God supplies. God gives power and strength to serve as a gift of the Spirit. So that begs the question, if we are burning out in the service to God's people, and I've been there, the question to ask if we're burning out is, am I relying on my own strength, or am I relying on God's power? Of course, we all need breaks at times, but maybe an even more penetrating question would be this. Am I truly serving to build the body of the church, or am I serving to build myself? If we find that we're burning out in service, the question to ask is, am I relying on my own strength, or am I relying on God's strength? And again, we all need breaks. We all need to have time off. But practical service is a gift. given through the Holy Spirit. The very power of God powers that ability. If we have this gift, we should be using it. The next gift Paul lists here is teaching. The third is teaching. And again, in Don and Katie Fortune's book, they describe the person with this gift as this: one who loves to research and communicate the truth. They say, we were tempted to use the word researcher because we found that many with this gift were especially drawn into fields of research and may or may not be overtly involved with the function of teaching. Or they may do their teaching through writing, papers, articles, dissertations, or books, rather than in person. But we found that the majority of people with this gift were also involved in some form of in-person teaching, too, so the teacher stands. All right, so we've gone through three of these lists of seven so far, and I know this is a lot to digest, so I'm going to pause here for a second. We've covered three gifts so far: prophesying or perceiving, practical service, and teaching. Maybe you're wondering, like me, if you've had time to think about these so far, is there a difference between perceiving or prophecy and teaching? Is there a difference? Well, there is a difference, and I think it's important to delineate what that difference is. So to do that, let's imagine that you're at a dinner party, and there are seven guests. Each one of these guests has one of the seven gifts that we're going through today in Romans 12, and you're carrying three plates out to serve food for these guests. Now, one of those plates slips from your hands and falls to the floor and smashes. How each person reacts to that is an insight to how these gifts influence their personalities. So the perceiver is the one who usually speaks up first. And he says, that's what happens when you try to carry too many plates. He immediately perceives the truth of the situation. And sometimes it's not really seasoned with salt, as they would say. The server, the second gift there, says, here, let me help you clean that up. The teacher, though, the teacher says, the reason you dropped that plate was that it wasn't balanced properly. Here, this is how you balance three plates. The way that I see the difference between these two things is the perceiver can tell the truth. The teacher can show you the truth. Both are incredibly important in the body of, or in the church, in the body of Christ. In some ways, it's a subtle difference between perceiving and teaching. But I think it's important to clarify, because sometimes we get frustrated with our fellow body members because we want a perceiver to be a teacher, or vice versa. We want a teacher to be a perceiver. They're different gifts. That doesn't mean that someone doesn't have both, which is possible. But they're different. We can't expect all members of the body to be able to do all things well. That's why there's different gifts given to the body as a whole. We're all supposed to work together, and the whole then is greater than the parts. Okay, so hopefully we've had time to pause now. The fourth gift here, mentioned in Romans 12, verse 6, the fourth gift Paul mentions in this list is exhorting. Exhorting. The teacher, again, Don and Katie Fortune says, the teacher aims for your head, the exhorter aims for your heart. It's not so much the content that the exhorter wants to impart as how that content can be made effective in people's lives. We could have called this person the encourager. In fact, the Greek word means a calling to one side to aid, denoting both exhortation and encouragement. The exhorter is one who loves to encourage others to live a victorious life. And we all need an exhorter in our life. We all need more exhortation in our life, for sure. The next one, number five, we'll speed this up. Number five is the giver. Giving or the giver. One who loves to give time, talent, energy, and means to benefit others and to advance the gospel. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. The giver will, without hesitation or silent judgment, give. Again, if we go back to our dinner party analogy, if you've dropped those plates, the giver, without hesitation or judging you for how you were carrying those plates, will say, I will be happy to help you make more food. They're happy to give their time, their energy, their material goods. That's the gift of the giver. Number six is leading, or the administrator. That's the sixth spiritual gift listed here. And again, I think that's fairly self-explanatory. The leader is one who loves to organize, to lead, and to direct. The final one listed here, number 7, is the one who shows mercy. Someone who is gifted with compassion. One who shows compassion, love, and care to those in need. One who is able then to forgive. So I put that in both columns there, the speaking column and the serving column, because it's really both. We've been covering mercy, the mercy of God, lately in the last 2 months. I think every message I've given so far, we've covered the mercy of God, his chesed. And God's mercy is so deep and it means so much. And some people have the gift of God's mercy. So that is a list here. You can take a screenshot there if you want, or a photo. That's a list of 7 specific spiritual gifts divided into 2 broader categories. The question is, where do you fit in that list? Have you ever thought about that? What gifts has God given me that I can exercise in the service of others? For us as first fruits, it's a major component of ensuring that when the master returns, we're going to be ready. And that brings us then to our final group of scriptures to finish off our picture here that we are painting today of exactly how each individual first fruit can be ready. And don't worry, this won't take very long going through these scriptures. I know that we've already read this so many times. And to set the stage for this, turn with me to 1 Corinthians 12, which we turned to this morning. 1 Corinthians 12 for this final group of scriptures here. 1 Corinthians 12, and we'll turn to verse 29, the end of 1 Corinthians 12. You may have remembered from before, I know I've thrown a lot of information here, but you may remember that there are 3 places that Paul talks about spiritual gifts. Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, and Ephesians 4. So we're coming now to the end of 1 Corinthians 12, the end of that discussion of spiritual gifts here. In verse 29, Paul concludes this discussion with spiritual gifts with, "Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? Earnestly desire the best gifts." So there's nothing, that's okay. "And yet I show you a more excellent way." It's okay to desire the best spiritual gifts, to serve the household of the master, but there's something better, something even more excellent, something we all must exercise if we truly want to be transformed and be ready at the end of the age. So we then come to our final group of scriptures here, which is 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13. Remember in Timothy, we read that God has given us not the spirit of fear, but a power of God's mind and of God's love. And this chapter here in 13 describes what this love looks like in action. And in many ways, this is the most important thing that we could have covered today. Unfortunately, we also have the least amount of time to cover it. So we'll read through this quickly. Don't worry, I'm going to give you a study resource that you can go to. If you haven't studied into this chapter, I'll mention a place that you can go and study it further if you'd like to. So verse 1, let's read verse 1. "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become like a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal." I listened to a sermon series on this by Bob Fay in Chicago. And he said, he told a story about, I think it was before he went to Ambassador College, I think he said. And he was in Spokesman's Club. And they taught him in Spokesman's Club. They said, if you're giving a speech and you're not trying to build up the audience, if you're not exhorting the audience to build them up in love, it's just noise. It's just noise. You aren't speaking out of love. It's just a clanging cymbal, no matter how great you think you sound. "And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me absolutely nothing." All spiritual gifts must be used, must be viewed through the lens of love, of outgoing concern. Unfortunately, it's the word love in English. We say we love our car, we love our children, we love our wife. All the same word, but obviously totally different meanings for all those. Godly love is outgoing concern for the other person. All spiritual gifts must be used, must be viewed through the lens of godly love. Verse 4. "And now Paul lists the attributes of godly love that we are to exercise. A list of 10 that I put here on the screen. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, and rejoices in the truth. This right here, this list, is what we, as first fruits, are being transformed into. This is what we should look like when we're ready. Now, we don't have near enough time to go more in depth into 1 Corinthians 13. If you do want to go deeper into this, I know many of you listening are longtime members of the church, and many of you will have heard of Gary Petty's Agape Love sermon series, those 8 sermons on agape love. If you haven't checked that out, go ahead and do it. He goes 8 sermons, 8 hours, I think even more than that, in depth in the 1 Corinthians 13 here. So you can Google Gary Petty, UCG, Agape series, and it'll come up. You can check out those sermons. And if you haven't listened to that in a while, because I went through those going through this today, if you haven't listened to that, listen to it again if it's been a few years, because there are a lot of really good gems in that series. Verse 7, bears all things. This is love. Bears all things. The word for bears here means covers all things. That's the attitude we're going to have in when we go through those Matthew 24 events. Believes all things. Not everything, like I used to believe, you know, conspiracy theories, but believes the things of God. Hopes all things. Endures all things. Endures all things that were talked about in Matthew 24, endures all those things at the end of the age, all of the lawlessness and the hatred that's going to abound. And then he says, love never fails. Love never fails. If we take these three groups of verses that we've gone over and put them together to like we did today, this picture that we have painted, and if we take action on these things, this picture is for us as a first fruit, is how we exercise the gift that you've been given in the service of others. And if you do that, if we do this, we will not fail. You will be wise and you will be a faithful servant, the one that has oil in the lamp, the one that profits as you buy and sell and trade talents. Now, we started the weekend by touching on what I call one of the scariest verses in the Bible for a first fruit. Matthew 7, verse 22 through 23. What these verses tell me is that many, many, many people have the wrong idea of what it means to be ready. It's possible to do the right thing with the wrong motivation and not be ready. That's a huge concept. It's possible to bury the incredible gift that God has poured out on us. Hopefully this afternoon we've been able to paint a clear picture of what being truly ready as a first fruit of God looks like. The Holy Spirit is within the church today, just as it was in Acts 2. It's just as powerful today as it was then. Let's be sure to engage, to exercise the gifts we have been given to edify and build up the body, so that when we stand before Jesus Christ, we will find the door to his kingdom is wide open.